responsabilidad de no devolver personas a un país donde pueden experimentar persecución.
Además de posibilitar el cierre del cruce fronterizo, el decreto endurece los estándares para examinar las solicitudes de asilo y favorece las deportaciones aceleradas, una situación que alarma a las asociaciones, quienes confían en que la justicia pueda revertirla.
Nuestra esperanza es que el juez ve, como muchos jueces han visto con reglas similares bajo la administración de Biden como la administración de Trump, que una regla así, que es contraria a la ley, es ilegal y no puede continuar.
En tanto, del lado mexicano de la frontera.
Está sintonizando Radio Pacífica, KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Ángeles, 98.7 FM Santa Bárbara. Estamos en recaudación de fondos. Su apoyo económico es muy importante. Llámenos al 818-985-5735 o pueden ver todos los obsequios que se ofrecen en la recaudación simplemente yendo a kpfk.org.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives and those of our children. I'm your host, Richard Wolf. I want to remind you that we have a volunteer, Charlie, who's ready and willing to take your comments, your suggestions for what you might like to see addressed on this program. You can reach him at charlie.info438@gmail.com, or if you want, you can also reach Charlie via Twitter, or now X, twitter.com/charliefabz, F-A-B-Z. Okay, we're going to be talking today about wealthy corporate rich people paying universities and governments to come down on student protesters. It's a remarkable story, and I want to build on a remarkable piece of reporting in the Washington Post. I want to talk about the head of Boeing, the company that has had more safety disasters in the last few years than anybody can remember any airline company having. I want to talk briefly about the workers at Mercedes-Benz in Alabama who voted against being represented by the United Auto Workers. And finally, about that old problem of private versus public transportation and why it's more important than the shift from gas cars to electric cars. Okay, let's jump right in. A very few days ago, the Washington Post, and in case you're interested, the date exactly, May 16th, Washington Post, carried a story about a recording it had obtained of a WhatsApp conversation among government officials and rich donors. The rich donors were pressing the government officials to use police in universities. They were probably pressuring the university authorities to do that too, to collaborate with the police to crush student protests, protests that were overwhelmingly peaceful and that were directed at a peace objective, namely a ceasefire in Gaza. These peaceful demonstrators, demonstrating for peace, were then crushed, often violently, by police brought in. But now we know from the Washington Post that private wealthy people were pressing the university authorities and the police and local mayors, especially the Mayor Adams of New York City, to do that. And the Washington Post article names names, and I want to share them with you. First on the list, the former Starbucks CEO, Howard Schultz. If you thought Starbucks was a warm and cuddly outfit, think again. We already know it from how they treat their workers. Now you can see what they use some of the money you give them for your cup of coffee. They use to press people to crush student protesters. The founder of the Dell Computer Corporation, Michael Dell. The hedge fund manager, Bill Ackman. And Joshua Kushner, founder of Thrive Capital and brother of Jared Kushner, former President Donald Trump's son-in-law. Oh, yes, the 1% are very busy crushing students' free speech, don't you know? Now, I want you to understand, beyond the horror of this, that they're using their money. These are among the richest people in the country. When you allow a few people to have this kind of money, then beyond their mansions and their yachts and all the rest of that, they also have the money to throw. These people promised huge amounts of money to some of the public officials they approached. Some of them already gave it to them. Others are threatening not to give it to them unless they get what they want. Here's an argument not to have extremes of wealth. Nobody, no public citizen, should be in a position to control what the government does. We'll never know whether the police might have come in anyway, and the university administrators might have called them anyway, but we now know that they got a big, fat, profitable push from the richest people in the country. And that, of course, leaves us with the question, what else do these rich people do besides intervening when students exercise their free speech rights on a major public issue of peace and war when the United States is funding that war? Well, they do their work on the president. They do their work on the senators and the representatives. They buy and sell politicians up and down, from the local mayor, Mayor Adams of New York was involved here, and all the way up. There's a deep meaning when you hear the next comedian remind us we get the best government money can buy. I want to turn next to a Mr. Calhoun. He used to be the CEO of the Boeing Aircraft Company. You know, the company that had major crashes that killed hundreds of people and that were shown then to have had serious safety failures. Yeah, that company where the door flew off an airline in mid-flight. The company that has had more safety problems and operational problems in the last few years than any other airline company. So the head of that, is he punished? The man where supposedly the buck stops, the guy who's finally responsible for an airline that has ads recently telling us how safety is their primary concern. Now, in 2022, he was paid $23 million. And they just voted, his board of directors and the shareholders, to raise his pay for last year to $33 million. He was rewarded, and they voted to keep him on the board of directors. You want to keep a guy who was in charge when you were directly or indirectly responsible for enormous safety violations and the risk they pose. Imagine a society that didn't reward such people, but punished them. Said, you know, this year you're only going to get $1 million, not 23 or 33, and we're going to use the other $50 million instead of paying you, helping the families cope, those that lost their loved ones, with what happened when they flew on a Boeing aircraft. Oh, no, no, no. We don't do that for them, and we don't punish the CEO. We reward him. And that's what Mr. Calhoun is doing as he smiles on the way to his bank. I want to turn next to the story, sad for folks like me, that the United Auto Workers, 4,500 of them, working for Mercedes-Benz in Alabama, voted against joining the union, about 2,600 to about 2,100, as I recall the vote. I want you to understand what that means. On one side was the Mercedes-Benz Corporation, an old German capitalist outfit, one of the biggest German capitalist corporations, working hand in glove with the governor of Alabama, and as you'll see in a moment, with the governor of half a dozen other southern states, who were actively working with the German capitalists to screw the American workers out of a union that might have gotten them a higher wage. They scared them. The governors of those six states said that there would be a risk to the jobs these people had if they voted for the union. Yeah, scare tactics, and they worked. But if you thought the government was supposed to be neutral in the fight between management and labor, you're wrong. If you thought that we understood that you should be neutral in such a battle, let the workers make their own decision. Don't threaten them. The company threatened and the government threatened. No wonder the workers were intimidated. The union has filed charges, as they are legally entitled to do, with the National Labor Relations Board about all of this. But I want you to know who the states are that actively worked against the United Auto Workers throughout the period we're talking about for years now. Ready? Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas. The Texas governor, that's the same man who 2 weeks ago pardoned a man convicted of murdering an innocent Black Lives Matter demonstrator who has a long history of violent racist activity, who had been found guilty by a jury in that state of Texas for having committed the murder of the person in the Black Lives Matter demonstration. Convicted and sentenced to prison. The governor of Texas, who worked against the union workers voting, the workers voting for a union, is the same guy whose politics and wisdom pardoned the racist murderer. Don't forget that. Think about that. Understand the connection. Okay. The last update we have time for is an old story, so I'll be real brief. The private car is the single most important cause, private cars and trucks, of air pollution, of injury and death on the road. It uses vast amounts of resources to produce vehicles, most of whom spend most of their life quiet, not being used, sitting on in a garage, in a parking lot, on the side of the street. The efficient way forward is to have public transportation, sharing the transportation would save millions of people's lives, jobs, you name it. And if there were some people who were not anymore employed in making cars because we wouldn't need half as many if they were properly public transportation, like we see happening to bicycles in many American cities, then the government could step in and make sure that there were jobs for the people who were no longer needed to make the cars. That's the basic issue.
we ought to have a transition from the private car to public transportation. Instead, because it's profitable, we get a transition from private gas car to private electric car. We've come to the end of the first half of today's show. Stay with us. We're going to be talking with a very interesting leader of organized labor when we come back. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of today's economic update. I am very happy. Indeed, I'm proud to bring back to our microphones and our cameras David Van Dusen, who's been a guest on our show before. To remind you, he is a longtime socialist thinker, organizer, and militant union leader. He served two terms as president of the Vermont AFL-CIO. From 2019 to 2021, and then again from 2021 to 2023. He was part of the Progressive United slate that ran for and won those leadership positions. He is also a member of the Democratic Socialists of America and a past member of Anti-Racist Action. David Van Dusen's latest book is entitled Insurgent Labor, the Vermont AFL-CIO from 2017 to 2023. It is published by PM Press. I believe it can be ordered already and will be released within a few weeks. Okay, so first of all, David, thank you very much for giving us your time and your thoughts once again. Last time you were with us, we talked about the remarkable achievement of you and your colleagues to win the elections and to be a remarkable new kind of leadership for an AFL-CIO statewide organization. So I want to begin not by asking you to tell us about that again, but by asking you to explain to us the following question I know is in our audience's mind. How was that possible in Vermont? Or the flip side of that question, why hasn't it happened in the other 49 states? And the hidden question behind that, could it, might it, is it already happening? Could you address that set of questions?
Well, first off, let me say it, Professor Wolf. It's an honor to be on your show again. Thanks for having me. But the question of organized labor and how we make the labor movement both more democratic, more focused on organizing, more progressive, and more effective is the central question of our times. In Vermont, we had to fight like hell to retake our unions, to run an insurgency campaign in 2019, followed up by the elections that have come after, where we built an unprecedented coalition of rank and file union members and leaders from all around the state, ranging from the building trades to AFSCME, college professors, the UAW, you name it. Frankly, it's very rare in the AFL-CIO that we have contested elections. There is a morbid old guard mentality that often exists within the labor movement that discourages democratic contests. But here in Vermont, we came close to death. In 2017, we had 20 delegates at our convention, 20 at our highest decision-making body that the organization has. That's as close to death as you can be without being 6 feet under the ground and dirt thrown on. At that point, myself and a number of leaders from around the state came together and said something has to change. So we launched an insurgency campaign. We went to the shop floor. We argued our case. We built a progressive platform called our 10-point program for union power, which is now the platform of the Vermont AFL-CIO, which among other things said, we have to build true rank and file democracy. We have to build power beyond the Democratic Party. We need to put a priority on organizing. We need to be unafraid of the strike. We need to build community alliances to amplify our power. And we must be international in our perspective. Once we have this platform in place and was built with, in conjunction with folks from all around Vermont, who made suggestions of how things should be different, we campaigned. And you know what the number one question was when we campaigned from the shop floor was, what's the AFL-CIO? Let that sink in for a minute. An organization that's supposed to support workers, be the political voice of workers in our state and nationally, and rank and file members didn't even know what the AFL-CIO was. So we use that as an organizing discussion to talk about what the AFL-CIO can and should be, why it needs to change, and why it has fallen flat year in, year out. And instead of building worker power, has done nothing but hitch our wagon to the Democratic Party and put all of our eggs in the basket of plate lobbying, which has bared very little fruit. So lo and behold, it's a long story. I get into it in my book. We did prevail in 2019, and we won three straight elections after that. And we have taken real steps to implement that program, to change the priorities, to build power beyond the major political parties. And today, there are twice as many AFL-CIO members in Vermont than when we came to power in 2019. We came to power, there were 10,000 AFL-CIO members in Vermont. Now there's 20,000. We are trying to show the way to be an example of experimentation here in Vermont that the other parts of the country can build on. So that is at least the start of our story. We have a long way to go. But when you say, is this happening in other places? The answer is perhaps not as fast as we need it to change. But yes, when we look at Sean Fain and the UAW with their new direction in politics, when we look at Sarah Nelson and the flight attendants, Mark Dimenstein, and the postal workers, we see that nucleus of change already taking form, and we're seeing real victories as a result. But for labor to grow its power, we need to democratize. We are not a democratic organization right now, and we need to understand that we have to build our power before we put the priority on the legislative or political agenda, right? They need to be afraid of us, the politicians, if they're going to do the right thing. And until we grow that power, that fear will not exist.
Let me put you a question. Partly you've answered it, but what is the biggest opposition you face? In other words, and what I'm looking for here is not so much opposition in the sense of the consciousness of the people you're trying to reach. I understand you've explained that. Who fights against you? What is the opposition that I assume fought you before you won these elections and is fighting you now to try to undo what you've achieved?
The answer to that is easy. It's those who have perceived power already. The Democratic Party has organized against us from the inception, and they have been vocal critics of every move we have done, which challenges the failed notion that it's in our best interest to blindly support a capitalist Democratic Party. But this might surprise you. Our second largest obstacle in furthering a more progressive rank-and-file-driven approach has been the national AFL-CIO. First under Richard Trumka, and frankly, the situation has not become particularly better under Liz Schuer. Instead of seeing our success, they seem to act as if we represent a threat to their established order. Now, from our point of view, if we look at union density in our country reaching a high point of 35%, give or take, in the 1950s, now down to 10% nationally today. And when you look at the repeated failures of organized labor to move a legislative agenda in Washington, D.C., be it the Free Choice Act under Obama or the PRO Act under Joe Biden, both of which have gone nowhere, we need to come to the rational position that what we have been doing has failed. And if we keep doing the same failed approach, cozying up to the Democrats, having coffee or a drink with the Speaker of the House, put in all of our resources into Democratic Party elections. If we are to be honest about things, that has led to our decline and the weakening of any sort of class-based strength in our country. So we need to experiment and we need to do things different. The Vermont AFL-CIO does not pretend to have all the answers, but we do know what we've done in the past is not good enough and we need to do something new.
How important, David, were connections, coalitions, alliances between your work with the United Slate and social movements, political activists, progressive, I assume, on other social issues that happened in Vermont, the way they were happening in most of the rest of the country, or at least most of the Well, most of it. How important were those alliances to what you've achieved?
They're very important. I mean, we could look at the mass protests that broke out after the murder of George Floyd and the rise of Black Lives Matter and demonstrations, not just in the major cities, but all across our own rural Vermont as well. We were proud to step forward and to put our alliance with Black Lives Matter, call for a significant police reform, call for the empowerment of Black communities, and put resources behind those efforts. Ongoing, we also have developed a very strong alliance, a two-way street with an organization called Migrant Justice, which is essentially organizing undocumented farm workers in our dairy industry. And they have managed to win real gains in our society outside of the traditional union structure. That continues to be an avenue we pursue. We've walked their picket lines, and they have walked our picket lines. But the bottom line is this. Look, the billionaires, the millionaires and the billionaires, the capitalist class, they have money and resources. This is what they have. They also have the media. They have all sorts of tools at their disposal. If working people are going to fundamentally be able to change politics in our country, if we're able to put forward and articulate a different vision for the future, one with more economic equity and more direct democracy, we can't simply stay in our own silos. We need to make alliances in the community. We need to make alliances internationally, be that with the solidarity with the folks in Palestine who are facing ethnic cleansing right now, or the revolution in Rojava, which is fighting themselves for a direct participatory democracy in northeastern Syria. Capital is international. We must be international, but we also need to do that hard work at the local level, in the towns, in the cities, in the neighborhoods, in order to build the type of power that's capable of challenging the status quo.
In the little time we have left, here's the big question. I know, because we get lots of emails, I know is in the minds of people listening and watching. Everyone is kind of excited, taken up with the obvious renewed militancy of the American labor movement, organized, unorganized. It's, you know, everywhere. It's just remarkable. Do you see a possibility that whatever is motivating working people to demand unions in a way they haven't before, to go on strikes, to get their needs met with an intensity and a commitment, and not just the victories, but the lopsided votes that many of these victories demonstrate? Do you see that having an overflow effect in that the labor movement can, in a way, stimulate among social movements something comparable to what is already percolating in the labor movement?
It has to. It has to. It's not a question of if it can happen. It has to happen. I had the pleasure of being at Labor Notes in Chicago with 4,000 other union members from across the country several weeks ago. And for the first time in my life, over 20 years in the labor movement, I heard major labor folks, international presidents, Sarah Nelson being one, Sean Fain being another, openly talking about the need for us to grow our power and grow our solidarity to the point where we can do effectively a political general strike. This has not openly been discussed at that level of the labor movement in generations. But for us to get to that point, we have to understand that our union density, even though in Vermont we have a higher and growing union density than the rest of the country, at the same time, our numbers are not there yet in and of ourselves. We need to develop those very deep relationships with workers who are not yet union as well, if we're going to be able to do things like that. And that means we're going to have to work very closely with such social justice organizations to support them in their specific struggles, just as we're going to need to ask them to support us in ours. But with 12.5 million people, workers, in the AFL-CIO, the AFL-CIO needs to be transformed and changed from within to make it that organization capable of making these connections and growing that strength.
David, I wish we had more time. These issues are all so important, but you've opened them up. You're pushing us. You're making your own story available. And your new book, Insurgent Labor, is one that I urge people to take a look at to learn all about this. We'll have you back. We'll keep track of you, and you hopefully will keep track with us. And to all of you that are my audience,